Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 22. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we get started, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who have very generously pledged to support this podcast. A huge thank you to Andy, Joanna, Christina, Sharon, Jenny, Julie, Noel. Thank you, Zon, Reluca, Dawn, Daniel, Leslie, Katie, Jenny G, Sarah, Shah, Beth, Carol, Caroline, Sally and Haynes. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family before February 28 and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. Next month's prize is a $50 gift card to TudorFair.com, home to a range of fabulous Tudor-inspired gifts curated by Heather Tesco from the Renaissance English History podcast. Thank you, Heather, for donating this wonderful gift. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about Edward Seymour is Janet Ambrosie Wertman. By day, Janet is a freelance grant writer for impactful non-profits. By night, she writes best-selling historical fiction, indulging a passion for the Tudor era she has harboured since she was 8 years old, and her parents let her stay up late to watch The Six Wives of Henry VIII and Elizabeth. Janet lives in Los Angeles with her husband and dog, and is happy to be within driving distance of her three grown children. Find out more about Janet and the Tudors at her website, www.janetwertman.com. My conversation with Janet straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Janet. How are you?
I am very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, that's fantastic. I would love it if we could just start by maybe you introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about your background.
So here we go. I loved the Tudors from way back and read everything about them, devoured all of the TV shows, the movies, the this and the that. But more recently started writing about them. It was something that I had been meaning to do forever, and I am very happy to be firmly along that path.
Fantastic. And was there one certain moment that you can remember that sparked your interest in the Tudors, or was it more just a sort of slow coming to love them?
No, it was an immediate zats.
Wow.
The Six Wives of Henry VIII back in the 1970s when I was 8 years old, and it was a big deal to be allowed to stay up late to watch the show.
Yeah.
I was on PBS and, you know, it was after my bedtime, but it was big enough that my mom, who was also a Tudor fan and a history fan, was excited to share that with me.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? I love that. So for some time now, I know you've been busy working on your Tudor trilogy, the Seymour Saga. Could you tell us about your novels and what inspired you to write about the Seymour family?
It was an accident. It was a complete accident. So I actually had always wanted to write about Anne Boleyn.
Right, yep.
We had this, what I believe to be a truly brilliant idea. Mm-hmm. I was going to write The Secret Diary of Anne Boleyn, and it was going to be Anne Boleyn's diary, but Elizabeth found it, and she would be reading the pieces as she was trying to put things together in her own life, and she would be all of the brilliant lessons that Anne had for her. And it was just, I was so excited about that. And I actually made it 150 pages into it. And then I was researching like a small piece, and you know how these things work. I went from one thing to the other.
Exactly, yeah.
Robin Maxwell had just published my exact book.
Oh, God.
The Secret Diary of Anne Boleyn, told from the perspective of Anne Boleyn's diary entries and Elizabeth.
Yeah.
My book.
Wow.
And it was parallel lives. She had been living on the East Coast and moved to California. I'd been on the East Coast, moved to California, first time author, you name it. It's like the universe gave us both the same idea.
Yeah. So
I, of course, went into a tailspin and a major, oh my goodness, what am I doing now? And right away I decided, well, okay, I'm just going to switch it. I'll just do Jane Seymour. Mm-hmm. Because it's basically the same story with just a few more years. And as I came to really think about it, I realized that it made for a more interesting story to see it not from Anne's point of view, but to see it just a little bit later in terms of what it did take me, I have to say, it took me like between 5 and 10 years to really move over into Jane's perspective from Anne's.
Yeah.
And as I did that, it suddenly hit me that the entire Seymour family really was the perfect vantage point from which to view almost the entire Tudor experience. They were right in the middle of just about everything. Almost all of the good stuff happens then. I mean, don't get me wrong, Elizabeth, you know, obviously, and then Catherine, but they really were in the center.
Absolutely, definitely. Now, it's funny that you mention Robin's book, because that was actually the book that sparked my love of the Tudors. So that book holds a very special place in my heart. Sorry, I'm sorry about your idea. You know what? There is actually a name for that. And if anyone listening can actually remind me, I have read before that this happens quite often where people have the same idea at the same time. And I have read that there's a name for it. It's kind of like the ideas are swirling around and it's whoever reaches for it first and acts on it. But if any listener can remember what it's called, because I haven't been able to find it. But isn't that interesting? All right. Well, book two in the series is called The Path to Somerset. What makes its protagonist, Edward Seymour, such a fascinating subject?
Pretty much the same thing that make the Seymours the fascinating family that they are. So Edward Seymour was right there. He had the perfect vantage point to absolutely everything that was going on. He was close enough to Henry to be in on all of the decisions, that he didn't really have to worry about a whole bunch of things. There was no one who was really in that kind of position and kind of closeness, and really just it in terms of my big thing during as I was writing it was to try to shove him into the room as often as I could.
Yes.
Because instead of having people like talk about, and then this happened and what did she say? That is not as exciting as when they are actually in the room. And Edward Seymour was almost always in the room.
Yes.
That was really the most incredible opportunity. And I was really thrilled during the entire writing of the book that he was right there.
Excellent. Now, he's not a person that I have really researched thoroughly at all. Do we know much about Edward's early life and his upbringing?
We know a few things. Mm-hmm. We know the Seymours were famous for their muse. So we know that he was really good at hawking. We can assume that part of the hawking, they also did a lot of riding because he started out as master of the horse to Henry Fitzroy.
Right.
So really did have like a good start, you know, in Tudor times. There was little that was able to really get you in good with the king than those kind of pastimes and being able to be good at that kind of gentlemanly stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We also know about his first wife, which I'm sure he wishes that we didn't know so much about his first wife. The woman who, she had an affair with his father.
Right, gosh.
And it was a long-term affair. This was when Edward left for court to try to make his name and his fortune and left his wife at home, pretty much assuming she would be safe with his family. But she embarked on a probably at least a three-year-long liaison with his father.
Gosh.
And the rumor is that his two oldest sons might have been his brothers.
Right.
And because of that, he ended up disinheriting them later, and he repudiated his wife and disinherited his sons. But interestingly, he disinherited them but let them remain at court with him, and
right.
They both throughout his life. It was an interesting situation.
Gosh, that is an interesting, another completely tangled tale about the Tudors, isn't it? So what about Edward's rise to power? Because obviously he rose to almost the ultimate power, didn't he? So could you talk us through that a little?
He had started to rise, not like George Boleyn did, but he had also started to rise within the Tudor court a little bit slowly. And then once Jane caught Henry's eye, that's when things really went quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at that point, then he went right from, you know, gentleman of the Privy Chamber, then he became on the Privy Council, then, you know, when they got married, he became Viscount Beauchamp, and then he got his earldom when Edward was born. So it really, you know, was very, very slow. And then, of course, Jane died.
Mm-hmm.
If she had lived, he would have been a duke much earlier. I'm going to guess the second son.
Yeah.
But instead, it took him a little bit more than that. And at that point, it really is, that's another thing that made The Path to Somerset such fun to write, was that this was when he really had to rely on his own skill and his own counsel and his own everything in order to rise. And at the same time, people were coming after him and just trying to be, trying to take his place, specifically the Norfolk family, the Howard family.
Right, yeah.
The Earl of Surrey. So this was, it was a tough path, but he did it really steadily and just kept going.
Yes, okay, fascinating. Now, was Edward the VI close to his uncle Edward? The Edward that we're talking, so many Edwards, it's like, so Edward Seymour, was he close to Edward the VI, the king?
When I was writing it, it's really funny that you say that. When I was writing it, so during The Path to Somerset, Edward refers to Edward Seymour, and then that book ends, and in The Boy King, Edward is Edward the VI, and Edward Seymour is Somerset. So
right, you know, that's good, because that helps, doesn't otherwise.
Exactly. If the books hadn't been separated like that, it would have been a little bit more of a problem. But your question was, were they close? Yes, early on.
Right.
Before Henry died, they were close. Edward Seymour had a son around Prince Edward's age.
Right, okay.
And they all, it really was a family thing. And Edward Edward Seymour tried to encourage that familial continuity.
So,
because that was really his source of power, was the fact that he was close to the prince and he was trustable.
Okay.
His future was only assured as long as Prince Edward was healthy, and their futures were intertwined. And
so
he was automatically trustworthy in terms of that. So he absolutely, I am very confident that it up for all it was worth. I think that once Edward VI became king, it became less important for him to have that personal connection. I think he started to take it for granted. Mm-hmm. I think he started to not really try to foster it as much.
Do you mean Edward Seymour didn't try? Is that, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think he did. I think that, you know, he was focused on ruling in his nephew's name,
right,
and was not focused on continuing that kind of affection. And I think that it became difficult. I think they lost it. I think that Tom Seymour, who had been gone for much of King Edward, Prince Edward / King Edward's life, was able to sneak in there, and Tom had always been the friendly one.
Yes,
And at that point, Tom was a little bit jealous of his older brother and started to rebel rouse and really kind of make it difficult for the two Edwards to maintain closeness.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you brought Thomas Seymour up, because it's hard to talk about the Seymours without, of course, mentioning Thomas Seymour. As you say, very affable character. We might use some other words to describe him too. How would you describe Edward Seymour's relationship with his younger brother, Thomas?
So it's interesting. I think that there was a distinct difference before Henry died and after Henry died. I think that the real rivalry arose on Henry's death.
Right.
Henry never gave Tom Seymour as much of a chance as Edward, never entrusted him with really important positions, even though he made an ambassador and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. A lot of that was to just get him out of the way and get him out of Catherine Parr's path.
Yeah.
So he didn't give him a lot of responsibility ahead of time. Mm. There was probably the normal amount of sibling rivalry before Henry's death. But then when Henry died, I think that Tom Seymour expected more than he got.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's when the wheels kind of came off the wagon, where he really wanted more, a lot more. And he saw that he believed that the only way of doing it was to bring Edward down, or not to bring Edward down, but Edward had taken two roles. He had taken the political role and the personal role. And Tom Seymour thought that he should be entrusted with the personal side
right.
of Edward VI's reign. And you know, part of that, especially once he married Catherine Parr, the argument, he's like, you know, come on, I should be entrusted with the king's person.
Right.
And when that didn't happen, I think the anger, the resentment really kind of boiled over.
Well, yeah, he took things, the situation into his own hands, didn't he, after that? Not very smart decision, but anyway. So in popular history, Edward Seymour, he's not often portrayed in a very favourable light. I'd like to hear more about the man you discovered in your research. What was he actually like, and what did his contemporaries think of him? What did they make of him?
the best... you know, the real quote, and I do believe that this is pretty much what everyone believed, was the imperial ambassador described him as a dry, sour, opinionated man.
Oh my goodness. That is not very favorable, is it?
No, not at all. I think that he never had Tom's bonhomie.
Yeah.
He was not a hail fellow well met. He was the serious guy who just kind of got things done.
Right, yeah.
And this might have been, you know, you look at him and you go, well, wait a minute, you were master of the horse. You were this whole hawking guy. What happened to that guy? I'm not really sure what happened. The way I dealt with it in The Path to Somerset was just terror. The last few years of Henry's reign, after Jane Seymour died, I cannot imagine what it must have taken to walk through that court every day. Mm. And that really will turn you very serious very quickly. So I think that that was kind of it. I think that he was not necessarily the most friendly of guys. And he was a believer in that he was a reformist, and he really believed it. And he was also, I like to say, that the Bernie Sanders of his day.
Right, yeah.
But he really believed that the common man needed a little bit of help, and that put him that set him at odds with a lot of all of the other noblemen, because that was all money coming out of their pocket. So his policies, what he really believed, were at odds with what with their own ambitions. And if you really look at it, it was also at odds with what Edward Seymour was actually doing. I mean, he built Somerset House, this thing, and he took all of these funds and he spent all of this money on it. And but still, he believed in elevating the common people. So it was a little bit tough. He was not well liked.
Yeah, no, that quote is. Goodness, you wouldn't want someone saying that about you, would you? Goodness. All right. So go ahead.
No, he was faithful to his wife.
Well, there you go. There's something we can say. Faithful, that, loyal.
That is something that was not very common.
No, absolutely not.
Not among men. I think probably because of what happened with his first wife, I think he kind of realized how big a deal that was and what betrayal meant, but I want to get that in there because that really says a lot about who he was.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Thank you for adding that. And obviously very different to his brother, Thomas, who, you know, scandals galore, I suppose, when it comes to Thomas. So on the 22nd of January, 1552, Edward VI notes in his diary, "The Duke of Somerset had his head cut off upon Tower Hill between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning." That's all he says about his uncle's execution. So could you talk to us about some of those key events that contributed to the Duke's dramatic downfall and execution?
That was huge. That diary entry is so incredibly poignant. It really just really kind of hits you in the stomach. And I'm incorporating diary entries throughout.
That's great.
The King to really kind of get the oomph
of things
because, you know, you have, you know, Edward's writing in his diary, you know, about his coronation and how he got to sit with his crown on for dinner and stuff like that. And you come to this and it's just like, oh my goodness. It was, I can only imagine that poor little boy having to make the decision to execute his uncle. The events mainly, I'm going to lay all the blame at the at Dudley's threshold.
Good old Dudley.
we need our villains. We just do.
We do.
and that's really what it was. So you had Somerset starting off with his policies against enclosures, which were detrimental to the nobility. He clearly made mistakes in Scotland, where he continued Henry VIII's policy.
Right.
It had worked for Henry, and it never really occurred to Somerset to change it. And so he, we'll just beat them up until they agree to marry the queen. That didn't work.
Right.
And so he had his failed policies, and then things came to a head with the coinage, which had been debased, although so much of that occurred in Henry VIII's reign. Mm. I mean, they started calling Henry VIII Old Coppernose.
Right.
because the coins had been debased so much that, you know, you could see the copper noble.
Right, yep.
The outside got worn away and the nose turned red from the base underneath. And so a lot of the stuff was not really his fault, but he ended up getting blamed for it. And he was not that great a leader, admittedly. And Dudley kind of took over and allowed him back onto the council, and at some point Dudley just decided, okay, I've had enough. Whether Somerset was really trying to get back his power, I don't believe that he was trying, that he planned to kill Dudley. The way he claimed, there's a lot of stuff that Dudley claimed he tried to do that not quite. Before he lost power to Dudley, he did kidnap Edward and brought him over to war, and that probably raised a bunch of the hackles in that poor boy's mind, because his other uncle, Tom, had also tried to kidnap him.
That's right. I was just thinking, yeah, that's just poor thing. Both uncles, goodness.
Both uncles. So it basically happened. There's this really amazing story, though, that he was at his trial acquitted of treason. So they didn't turn the sword towards him the way they do after trials. Like, you're acquitted of treason, they turn the sword.
Exactly, yeah.
And so the common people thought that he was going to live, and so they all started cheering. And Edward, I forget what palace he was in, but he might have heard that cheering and thought his uncle was going to live. But he had been, meanwhile, convicted of felonious intent, and you wouldn't think that that would carry the death penalty, but it did. So acquitted of the terrible thing, but found guilty of something that killed him anyway.
Something else. Well, it's interesting, your interpretation of Edward VI's sort of involvement and reaction is very interesting, because there are other sort of versions of the story that you read, which people read into that one statement that Edward wrote in his diary as very detached, very kind of uncaring for his uncle, very cold, and Edward's often described as those sorts of things. So you think that doesn't sort of reflect that at all?
I actually don't. I see him as just feeling almost kicked in the stomach, you know, detached. Yes, I will give you detached. But you know, this is a kid who, what a horror. I mean, I think.
Yeah, of course, he was very young, and I think we forget that sometimes, don't we? But definitely I see traits of his father in that kind of ability to detach from these sorts of things, and you know, that kind of thing.
He almost had to. I actually have, I was so proud of myself for this. I had one scene in The Path to Somerset. I had Henry, a scene where he suddenly like grabs Edward and just says, you know, traitors, they're going to come, like, this is shortly.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, traitors are going to crop up and you have to cut them out of your life, out of life. And I have that in The Boy King, you know, Edward reflecting on that. His father had to kill two wives, and now he had to kill two uncles. And it kind of, it put that into perspective for him, or in my mind, it does.
All right, thank you. That's great. So out of all the misconceptions that exist about Edward Seymour, what do you think is one of the most persistent ones?
The most persistent one, and the thing that people still have the biggest problem with him today, much, much more so than back in the day, but the problem that people have with him today is that they go, oh, he murdered his brother. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sorry. You really, I don't think that he deserves the blame for that. I don't really think that he had a choice. Interestingly enough, because I'm writing The Boy King from Edward VI's perspective, you know, I actually think that Edward Seymour would have given his brother more of a pass, because he saw Tom as coming after himself more so than the king.
Than the king, yeah.
If you're a 9-year-old boy and you saw your dog dead on the floor trying to defend you, I don't think that you could ever forgive that. I mean, I think that was really the point at which you can't expect to live after like that. He broke into the king's apartments at 1 o'clock in the morning with the intent to abduct him. Whether or not we believe that he intended to kill him, whether or not, I mean, what he did, that was treason. And I don't think that Edward Seymour can be blamed for enforcing the laws that he didn't have a choice about. That was just treason.
Yeah, so. It is part of a much bigger sort of debate, isn't it, that I've seen a lot lately about assessing, obviously, the past with our 21st century eyes, and it, you know, how else can we do it? We can't detach from ourselves, but it's I think it's important to look at the context, isn't it? And to see, try and see things from their perspective. And as you say, he had committed treason and the punishment for treason was death. So, all right. So during your extensive research, you've spent a lot of years, as you've already mentioned, researching the Tudor court, fascinating Tudor court. Did you discover in that time anything that kind of really surprised you that you didn't know? Or
So yes and no. So there wasn't really one single event, but it's really about putting things together in ways that I hadn't really considered. So it was all stuff that I knew, but then I fit it together slightly differently.
Right, okay, yeah.
So things like the fact that, so I knew that Somerset was Fitzroy's master of horse. Mm-hmm. And I knew that Surrey was good friends with Fitzroy. And it never really hit me until I was writing The Path to Somerset that their relationship really went way back.
Right.
And the enmity that had been between them really went way back. And the same thing happened in Jane the Queen when you really think about the fact that the Seymours and the Boleyns were cousins. One thing to just say, oh, they're cousins, but okay, what does that mean for a 7-year-old growing? Because when your cousin, you spend time with your cousins. What is it like to be, you know, I don't know about you, but there's comparison. And, you know, how did that work out and things like that? The same way it hit me, I'm trying to remember, it was either Philippa Gregory or Alison Weir's book about, like, the younger Anne Boleyn. And I always knew that she was in the court of Margaret of Austria, but all of a sudden it hit me, oh, my goodness, she would have met Charles V.
Yeah.
That blew me away.
Yeah.
About that, because the stuff that happened before we really had them in our sights and were really paying attention, that long history that you really can't forget about. I think that was amazingly fun, and all of those pieces I really enjoyed.
Yeah, that's so true. The new connections, exactly. I agree with you. I have been looking at the life of Henry VII a little more. And to me, for some reason, I don't know why, Henry VII was always an older guy. He was never, in my mind, he was never a young man. And so looking back at his life, it's so nice to actually now meet the young Henry VII, you know. So it's true, those connections that you kind of know are there, but you don't really think about them too much. So yeah, that's really interesting. So I think you're working on a new book, is that right?
Yes. The boy, it is the final entry in the Seymour saga. And it's poor little Edward.
Poor little Edward. All right. And so when is this book out for going to be released, this year or next year?
No, it takes me about a year and a half to 2 years between the writing, and I'm in 3 different critique groups.
Right, okay.
You know, to get feedback on all of that and editing. So it my guess is 2020.
Okay, that's great. And do you have any research trips planned? Are you going to do any walking in the footsteps of Edward VI?
I am hoping to, but I don't have the trips planned. My big trip happened. I worked out the perfect timing for The Path to Somerset because I found the portrait of Edward Seymour at Sudeley Castle.
That's right. Yes, I remember you mentioning.
It's a portrait that is not online. They never put it online. They never did that whole thing. So nobody's ever seen that except for, you know, obviously there have been thousands of people who have visited Sudeley Castle.
That's right.
So all those people have seen it, but it is not a portrait that we know. But that's the portrait that I was writing about. The only other portrait that I would have been able to use was the Holbein portrait, where he really does look dry, sour, and opinionated.
Yes. He does, yeah.
But in this one, the Antonio Moore, you know, the guy who did Mary First and all of those others, he's the tortured witness to history. That's my Edward.
Right. So, That's interesting because I have visited Sudley on a number of occasions and that one doesn't stand out in my mind and it's so annoying. I must have not, maybe I just, I don't know what happened. I can't really remember it.
It was, well, it just kind of hit me. I turned around a corner. I mean, it's not huge. It's, you know, regular thing. And I just, it hit me and I was like, oh my goodness, I recognized him immediately. And I was glad I was right.
Yeah.
And it was just, I was so thrilled. And then I was, then of course I was terrified because it took about a year for the book to come to market. And I was like, oh my goodness, somebody else is going to publish the cover and they're going to make a big deal about the portrait. So I was like, no, I got to unveil it.
Fabulous. That's great. Well, Sudley Castle, come on, we want to see this portrait. What's happening? Yeah, definitely. It's time to share, I think. All right, Janet, well, this has been such a fabulous discussion. It's really nice to talk about someone that, you know, we don't talk about too often in the Tudor world, Edward Seymour. It's time to play our game of 10 to go. Are you ready for our quick 10 questions, unrelated really to, oh no, some are history related, but generally not. You ready to go?
I am ready.
Oh, right. What's something you do to recharge the batteries?
Walk my dog. I was about to say meditation, but the truth is I walk my dog.
That's lovely. Yeah, that sounds good. Do you have a song? Not everyone does, but do you have a song that kind of instantly lifts your mood if you're feeling a little bit down?
Oh, dear. You would think that I would. I can't.
That's okay. It's you're going to find one now, I'm sure, and you can tell us later.
I'll be like emailing you afterwards. Yeah. Going, no,
that's okay. I always forget song titles, by the way. So if someone ever asked me that, I'd be like, oh my God, I can't remember titles. What is, apart from writing and walking your dog, what's something that brings you joy?
See, it really is writing. I know you said apart from writing.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I shouldn't have said that. That's making it tricky.
So it's really funny. It's my day job and it's my hobby.
So great. That's fantastic.
The day for nonprofits and I do historical fiction at night. So it's really, you would think that I should find an unrelated hobby.
No, that's okay. There's probably not enough time for it, is there? Gosh. All right, fabulous. So what's what was a favorite childhood book of yours?
The Laura Ingalls Wilder books.
Someone else mentioned those, I think.
I was just reading about those the other day, I think because, I know why I was reading about those, because they renamed, there was the Laura Ingalls Wilder Prize for children's fiction, and they decided that now that they've reread the books in the present day, they find her a little bit racist. So,
all right, okay.
That was my childhood book, but Shogun, James Clavell's Shogun, I consider the greatest book ever written, and I reread it probably once a year.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's why I haven't read it, so I just noted the name down so I can add it to the list. All right, fabulous, thank you. Do you have a favorite holiday destination?
Holiday destination?
Yeah, where do you like to go on holiday?
Cabo San Lucas, Mexico.
Mexico, there you go. I haven't been. Do you go regularly?
I've gone about 4 times. It is close to Los Angeles where I live.
Right, okay.
It is a very quick, you know, it's an easy place to get to, and it's wonderful in the summer and in the winter.
Beautiful. Sounds great. Let's see. What was your first paid job?
My first paid job, I was a counter waitress at Chock Full of Nuts, and I got fired summarily after about 2 weeks because I couldn't yell the orders.
Oh.
The grill person, I would like run back and, you know, 2 eggs.
Oh, down, right, yeah.
Back, and he finally yelled at me, and a customer took my side and said, "Stop it! You know, it's your fault that, you know, you're the one who got the order wrong." And I got fired because the customer defended me. I was like 13. They really kind of allowed people to. Back in the 70s, you really could get away with a lot of stuff back then.
Yeah, you could. That's true. Well, you mentioned your 13-year-old self. So if you could go back and give your 13-year-old self a piece of advice, what would that be?
Start writing earlier. So that then I would have beaten Robin Maxwell to the punch.
And we love you, Robin. Nothing against Robin Maxwell. We love you, Robin.
although you know what? No, I'm going to take that back, because I am actually really happy with the way things turned out. I am very happy with the Seymour saga. So I take that back, and I'll have to find a different piece of advice for my 13-year-old self.
That's fine, not a problem. What qualities do you most admire in others?
Humor, honesty, yes. Consistency. I don't like when people are inconsistent or take inconsistent points of view. I like, you know, it's if you believe something, then believe it all around, as opposed to just situational.
Right, yep. Very good. And I think humor is so important. My goodness, so important. What does your writing space look like?
Well, I have, it is my office has slightly pinkish peach walls, and I look out on a front garden and a side garden, and it's just very comfortable.
Lovely. I love little havens to write in. That's just really beautiful. And lucky last question, you're going to have a historical dinner party, and you can invite any 4 or 5 people from history. Who would you like to invite to your party?
So it's really funny when you say things like that. All I can think of is a flashback to my wedding when you know, and this was like 30 years ago, but like trying to put together the tables so that people got along.
That's right.
Couldn't go in certain tables with each other. So on the one hand, it's like, you know, well, I'm on Jane Seymour and Anne Boleyn. It's like, but they have to be.
They have to be separated, those two, I think.
But I definitely would. I would love to put together. I would love can I have a series of dinners so that I can just put together? I think it would be a lot of fun to put. See, now I'm flashing out. I would love to get like Edward Seymour and the Earl of Surrey, you know, and put them see what happens at the same time.
Social experiment, that's what we call that.
Exactly. I think that would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, wouldn't it be fun if we could do it? I'd love to do that. All right, so we're up to our Tudor takeaway. So at the end, we just like to offer our listeners something that they can explore after the show. Do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
I do. Cobbett's State Trials. I think that is one of the most fun resources that you can just sit there and page through. I think it's I love it. So one of the things I do when people subscribe to my blog, I give them the like a list of my favorite resources.
Oh, and that's great.
I always like try to focus on that one. I'm like, whatever you do, make sure that's the one, because that is just, it is, oh, it's wonderful. It really is. It will, because it not only gives you the trials, it gives you a whole bunch of the other stuff and the rumors leading up to the trials, and then what people said around it, and you've got like the little rumors. And I'm trying to remember if that's where we heard the story of how Surrey tried to escape from the tower down the waste pipe or
right. Gosh, that sounds like fun. I like that. So was there something before State Trials? Was there a
Cobbett.
All right, Cobbett State Trials. I'm trying to think if I've been there. I'll have to check it out myself after this to make sure I haven't missed it in the last 10 years. That is fabulous. I think people are going to have a lot of fun exploring that, Janet. And what a pleasure it's been talking to you. Thank you so much for making time to chat Tudors with me. I absolutely love it.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been, it is such a wonderful treat to be able to talk Tudors to my heart's content.
Oh, tell me about it. I love it. It's my lifesaver, actually. It may have saved my marriage too, actually, just quietly. All right. So have a lovely day, and good luck with the writing of the third book as well.
Thank you so much.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon. Thank you.